Call the meeting, the January 19th, 2016 meeting of the City Council. Let's stand together and salute our flag. And just a courtesy reminder, we leave out the imagined comma after One Nation.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Our city clerk will now do the roll call.
Councilmember Czar, here. Councilmember Hansen,
here.
Councilmember Olson,
here.
Councilmember Taylor,
here.
Councilmember Watson,
present.
Councilmember Birch,
here.
Councilmember Goodrich,
here.
All here. I had a request from the audience to speak into the microphones. You have important things to say, and so go ahead and use it. During this time of our meeting, we have public comment. This is time for the audience. Anyone here wants to speak on any item that's not listed as an agenda item, we'll give you those opportunities later on. So if anyone has anything to say, come to the microphone, introduce yourself, and you have 3 minutes. A lot of takers today, huh? Great. Seeing that that's not going to happen, we'll go on to the meeting, and I will entertain a motion to adopt the consent agenda.
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
So moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Going on to capital projects update with our project manager, Katie Ratter. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, Council. My name is Katie Ratter. I'm the Public Works Project Manager. I've got a few things to talk about. It's kind of the slow time of year, so we're finishing up a few projects. One is our Pump Station 4 project. For those of you that aren't very familiar with that, the city has a sewer pump station on Smith Road, just west of Labounty. The city undertook a project earlier this last year. We are in 2016 after all. To upgrade that sewer pump station and rehab it. It's about 4 years old. So pretty much all the work is complete with the exception of some small added electrical work to allow for some duplicity, I guess is the word, while the pump station's running. Pump stations, you always want to make sure you have a backup plan, so that'll allow us to do some of that stuff. Our budget looks pretty good on this project. Once that electrical work is complete, we're anticipating a budget surplus of about $50,000 on that project. So Tiger Construction was the contractor doing that work, and they've done a great job for the city. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that project. No? Okay. Next, the other project that we have pretty much wrapped up is the Molloy Sewer Project. It's complete. All that's left is the paperwork, which actually seems a little bit more daunting sometimes than the construction itself. Our construction budget is looking good on that one, too. That project actually replaced an existing sanitary sewer, upsized the line on Molloy Road and Thornton, north of Thornton. We're doing pretty good on the budget for that one as well. We're anticipating having about $125,000 left over when everything's said and done on that. So if anybody has any questions about that project. Okay. Next is the Main Street pavement repair and citywide crack sealing project. For the most part, that project is complete. The city did actually include as part of the contract to replace some of the raised pavement markers, RPMs, on Main Street between 3rd and I-5. So the contractor is actually waiting for, just like the rest of us, waiting for some dry, warm weather to get that done. And so I don't really have an anticipated schedule for that, but they'll be completing that as soon as they're able. And we're looking good on the budget on that one as well. So I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. Okay. All right. Next on the list is the library crosswalk. I'm not really going to spend any time talking about that. It's an item on the agenda later. Kevin will be covering that, but we're putting that forward for consideration for awarding the bid. As far as projects that we've got coming up on the horizon in the hopper, as my notes say here, one is Washington Street, and that is basically installing sidewalks where none exist presently, bringing them up to full ADA standards from Vista Drive to 3rd Avenue, basically down there where the high school and the fire station is. We're working on design for that project. Like I said, it'll include installation of sidewalks. There'll be some pavement rehabilitation, so we'll be fixing rotten portions of pavement, fixing that up, and then we're looking at doing some waterline work in case we've got an old waterline there. We don't want it to blow up and ruin our new improvements, so we're looking at that. We are looking at going out to add early spring 2016 so we can get that work done while school's out. Next on the list is the Main Street LeBounty Roundabout, which... Oh, yes.
That project came up at the fire district meeting. Some of the, I don't know if it was commissioners or Chief Russell or somebody was asking about the scope of that project and what impact it may have on their fire station there. Give them a heads up. You know, they'd appreciate that once you figure out what the total scope is going to be, if we're going to do the water line or not or whatever, because they were asking about that so they can start planning ahead.
Definitely. Definitely. We'll call them and talk to them and work with them on that, make sure there's no impact. Another project that we have going is the Main Street LeBounty Roundabout, which now includes some sewer signal and storm conveyance work. We're finishing up design, working on a right-of-way plan to see what kind of rights that the city might need in order to construct that project fully within the right-of-way. We're on track to get the design done with the goal of being ready for construction summer 2016. So that's our goal there. Next on my list is the Third Avenue project. We're moving forward, hopefully for construction in 2016. Wendy LaRocque actually received a DOE grant for that project to get design and some of the construction paid for. So those plans have been prepared and they've been sitting waiting for us to move forward on that project. We need to look at some things and make sure that everything, our cost estimate for one, because the cost estimate was prepared, I think, in 2014 is updated and everything's current, so we can go out to add on that. So that project's still underway. Let's see. We also have the Central City Water Association conversion project. I think Central City actually got the loan from the Commerce Department. Oh, the city did. Okay. So there's a U.S. Department of Commerce loan to help fund that project, and basically what that will do is that will convert the Central City Water Association customers to City Water. Will upgrade water utility lines along Crestline and Heights and Hilltop and that sort of thing. We're moving forward with design on that as well, with construction scheduled for this year. Some other projects we're still working on is the Thornton Road sewer project. And what that would do is that would tie into the existing project that we just finished with Stremler there on Thornton and Malloy, extend a sewer east and go under the railroad tracks. We're looking for at SOQs for that project for the design. There's some elements there that we need to take a look at, so that's moving forward as well. And then finally on my list is the Thornton Road Extension Project, which is basically the overpass over Burlington Northern. Shearer Design is working on the preliminary design for that project, and I do believe that Greg and Kevin are working on getting Shearer up here to give you a more detailed update on the work that they've been doing and provide you with some information. So I don't know if you have any questions about what we've got underway for design.
Questions? Councilmember Goodrich.
Just for the audience and for maybe our new council members, can you say what you mean by going out to add or bid or whatever kind of the process that you do and how people are notified so they can bid on the project?
So when the city completes design on a project, then we have a set of PS&Es. I could inundate you with a bunch of acronyms that I can hardly remember. Plans, specifications, and an estimate. Basically, it's a bid package. It's the set of plans. It's all the information that you put out to the contractors. Usually, you do an ad. It needs to run for a certain amount of time in the paper of record, which is the Burndale Record Journal. Notifies contractors that they can bid on the project. and they submit bids based on those plans and that estimate and that information. And so by saying going out to bid, that's what I mean. Try to get a price for construction.
Question? Yeah. Other questions? Councilmember Watson.
I'm just curious, if you're going to be working on Washington Avenue and Main and LaBounty at the same time, is that going to, I mean, traffic-wise, that would just be a nightmare because no one, people wouldn't be able to go home Washington Avenue. Is okay. You see the look on your face? All right. I'll be out of town for 6 months. I guess, is there any way to do one before the other? You know, start the, get the Washington Avenue to a point where we can actually get through there and then destroy Main Street?
I think we could look at phasing the project so that we're not disrupting the entire traffic around the city. But, you know, that's one thing that we have to be aware of is, you know, we have a rather short construction season that we need to fit things into and just making sure that our plans work so that people can still get home. So, yeah, it's definitely a consideration that could be.
Okay. Because Washington Avenue is one of those ways that you can get home if Main Street's a mess. And if you have both, then people will be unhappy. I'll give your phone number.
Good question. Are there more questions of our project manager?
I do have one thing that we would like to brag about. The city recently, and you've probably seen information about this, but the city recently, at least since the last update I provided, received quite a bit of actually some grant money to get some projects underway. In late November, the Transportation Improvement Board, and this is the Washington State fuel tax, anyway, they awarded the city some grant money for their 2017 call for projects, and that included over $730,000 for Washington Street. That would be to reconstruct Washington from basically Main Street to Vista Drive. Our total construction cost estimate is right around $1.9 million. But 81 projects were actually submitted to the TIB for that funding source, and only 35 projects were awarded any grant money, and Fundo was one of them, so we were very successful with that project. The city also received over $680,000 for Portal Way pavement rehabilitation, and that's basically from Enterprise Road to Grandview. It would be a project very similar to our Barrett Road project that we completed a couple years ago, where the city ground up the road and basically resurfaced it. Anyway, TIB awarded the city money under their arterial preservation program. There were 42 projects that were that had submitted to receive grant funding, and we were one of 28 to actually receive funds for that. So pretty happy about that. The other thing is earlier this month we learned that we received a $250,000 grant to start design on reconstructing Ferndale Terrace. Basically to rebuild the street and include some LID or low impact development features to address some stormwater quality issues there. So we're looking forward to moving ahead and getting a design started. Hopefully we can grab some construction money. Anyway, that's all I have.
Any more questions? Thank you, Ms. Ratter.
Right.
Glad that you're here.
Thank you.
And the next item is a public hearing, and Yuri's going to take us through how we're going to help developers meet some low-impact, speaking of low-impact, development goals that we have. And this is a public hearing.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, Council. Wendy LaRock with our Stormwater Public Works is going to give you a quick overview of stormwater, and then I'll talk about the proposal to change it.
Welcome.
Good evening. I'm Wendy LaRock, the stormwater manager for the city. So, like Dory said, I'm just going to kind of go over stormwater, the city's regulations, and the background as to why he's presenting the code changes. Stormwater is basically any precipitation, and in undeveloped forested conditions, rain falls on the ground, and if it makes it to the ground, a lot of it is absorbed through plant material. When it falls on the ground, most of it infiltrates. Some of it also goes through evaporation, but only a small amount trickles out and actually leaves the site. In the developed urban condition, there's all the pavement, houses, buildings, all the impervious surfaces. So when rainwater hits that, it sheets off. And this creates a multitude of problems for the natural environment and also for people. one of those problems is that when the water sheets off, it picks up a lot of speed. So that causes erosion, and when the water actually hits a water body, it causes a lot of the soil to be disturbed and turbidity to happen, which is bad for salmon. Another reason stormwater in the developed condition can be problematic is that when the stormwater hits the paved areas, it sweeps out all the pollutants that's on the impervious surface. So any paint, oil, dog poop, you name it, is going into the local water body. Another problem that, I won't go into all of them, but I guess the last one I'll address is that the impervious surface is keeping the water from infiltrating into the ground, as I said, so wetlands, wells, and aquifers aren't getting recharged. So the water isn't turning into groundwater that's staying on that site. So the Environmental Protection Agency has mandated the Department of Ecology at the state level to basically regulate stormwater. And the way that the state does that is through what's called the Municipal Stormwater Permit that cities and counties and large entities such as like a port, they're permittees of that permit. Basically, what the permit says is that we can discharge two water bodies of the state, which is like a river, stream, a ditch, pretty much everything except the water that's in our pipes and stormwater facilities, if we follow these certain regulations. And one of the regulations is to control how the urban development affects or impacts stormwater. In the past, how we've done that is the big stormwater ponds that you guys have probably all seen in your neighborhood. So we pipe the water from the house, from the development, through the pipes to the detention pond. The idea is basically in that pond, the water settles, the pollutants settle to the bottom. Sometimes there's plants, they can uptake the pollutants. And then the water goes out a single source at the pre-developed forested rate. So it's slowed down. So that kind of covers some of the problems, but the major problem that that doesn't cover is the infiltration, right, on site, all the water still being shunted to one area, leaving downstream. So what ecology has basically said in our last permit is that we need to try to mimic the forested native condition. And the way they want us to do that is first to look, it's called low impact development, LID. First, we look at site design, you know, what areas can be preserved, are there native trees that can stay, how can you configure your site so that there's less impact, can you cluster, can you make streets smaller, etc. And once you've done that, then you look at what are called low-impact development BMPs, best management practices, and those are going to be bioretention, so like rain gardens is what they used to be called. Now the terminology's changed, but bioretention is basically a depression with plants in a specific soil profile that the water goes through to be filtered, slowed down, cleaned out before, you know, it becomes groundwater. You could also kind of do hybrid scenarios where there's a rain garden or bioretention and then it goes to a pond, you can have a smaller pond. There's green roofs, pervious pavement. I know you guys have probably seen those videos where people are pouring the water and it's just cheating through. Let's see. Another one would be rain barrels, as an example. So basically, in 2017, next year, any development needs to first look at these low-impact development BMPs before they can look at the traditional stormwater BMPs. So they need to prove that the low-impact development is basically financially infeasible before they can do a traditional. So I'll give you an example. In Ferndale, there's a lot of clay soil. So the water's not going to go anywhere. It's going to hit that clay, just, you know, stay there or shoot down below the soil. And so in order to do LID, you'd have to bring in so much amended soil that it'd be cost prohibitive, basically. So a development in an area with a lot of clay soil could prove with floor testing that they can't do it, basically. Their development wouldn't happen. So once they do that, then they can do the traditional. So in order to implement all these low-impact developments, ecology has also said that by that time, we need to go through all our codes, standards, regulations, and make sure we know the areas that are prohibitive to this type of development. And when we find those areas, we need to have frank discussions on why those regulations or codes are in place. you know, are they remnants from the past? Do they really represent the most, the best available science, or is it something we can change, or is there a good reason? So basically, that's what staff has been doing, is going through our codes, and so Yori's going to be bringing the first batch tonight to you, and you'll see examples of, you know, when it's a good idea to change and when, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to change. So are there any questions from Yori steps up?
I have a quick question from Wendy. Pervious surfaces, we have driveways, sidewalks, parking lots, street. Where is the technology on that? Because that is our biggest culprit.
I mean, there's a lot of people doing research. In Puyallup, they have a huge stormwater center where they're doing all different types and companies of pervious pavers or concrete, asphalt. And I think it's kind of still up in the air, and that's why it's a little difficult for cities, because there aren't specific standards for all this low impact development. There's guidance, but they're still working out the kinks. And I know on the pervious concrete and asphalt, for example, they're not having great success in parking lots where you're backing up and turning a lot, or on heavily traveled streets. It's also an issue if you have an
they
oil
can't
fill.
Be as strong. It just can't be as,
So, I mean, there are definitely specific applications that work for certain technologies, and I think, you know, that's just where we're at basically now, is you have to have a good application. For example, for on 3rd Avenue, we're not going to do the streets in pervious concrete or asphalt. I don't even know. Obviously, I'm not the construction person. But so we're going to do the bike lanes. And, you know, some people have had a lot of success. Other people say, well, all the pollutants are going to shunt off onto that, and then you're going to be filtering the worst of the water. But, you know, at least we will have the treatment there, whereas now we have nothing. The water's just cheating off.
So did I hear you say that the bike path may be pervious?
Right,
Well, that's something.
And so that's, with all the grants we can get from ecology now, that's the kicker. We have to be able to demonstrate and, you know, implement low-impact development or no money. So,
any questions? Thank you. Our community development director has been working hard on this with the rest of staff. This is the big ticket item tonight, so you've got us.
All right, no pressure. So thanks, Wendy, and Wendy's been really great. As our partner in this, where it is a difficult process sometimes, because we do have 40 years, 50 years worth of codes that inadvertently oftentimes do create these barriers to low impact development. We also, as Wendy was saying, recognize that some of the low impact development approaches are somewhat untested and might not be able to be used in all cases. So one of the things that the Planning Commission really asked us to focus on was not rewriting the codes in a way that is the exact polar opposite of what we have now, that creates barriers to the traditional techniques when it is only those traditional techniques that could actually work. So we think that what we've created in general is something that says, yes, you need to reject the low impact approach first. You need to show that that won't work. And if you can, though, show that it won't work, we're going to allow you to use more of the traditional or hybrid approaches. But first and foremost, look at what you can do and feel that you have the permission to be somewhat creative in what you do. So what you can do here tonight, after I present it to you, we have, seven different code sections. You only need the one public hearing, and you can approve them all as one agenda item. If for some reason you want to pull off one of them and consider it separately, you could also do that. But we are recommending that you approve them all en masse as one of one ordinance, and that will pave the way for us bringing you the next batch in the next couple months. So what I'm going to do is very quickly go through each of the chapters. I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time on them, or I'll try not to. The first one is the public institutional zone, where this is a zone that things like City Hall or the library or Whatcom County Jail, things that are publicly owned, often buildings, most of the time buildings, would go in. What we've always wanted to do with this chapter is say that public buildings are going to be the example for private development, where we are going to employ different sorts of development. Maybe it is where we are going to have rain gardens. Maybe the first solar array in Ferndale is going to be on a public building. The first wind-generating facility in Ferndale was in a public facility at Ferndale High School. Trying to push the envelope with the public buildings. So what we tried to do here would be to allow those low-impact approaches first and foremost, but then also acknowledge that there are other things that we might use public facilities or ownership for, such as the not now well-looked at regional stormwater ponds, regional wetland mitigation, that sort of thing. That kind of paves the way for us to be able to consider those things in the future. Next chapter, chapter 18.74, is the Ferndale Landscape Standards. This is probably where we see the most changes. And really what we're wanting to do here is to say we require the landscaping for aesthetic purposes, to screen other uses that are dissimilar from their neighbors, to create some sort of green belt oftentimes. And the great thing with a lot of the low-impact approaches is they're green themselves. The bioswales and even just the preserving the natural vegetation is exactly what ecology is looking for. So what we're proposing to do, and what we've actually always done, but we haven't had it in code, is to say, gosh, you know, if you have a required green buffer or if you have a required landscaping element, provided that your stormwater engineer can show that an LID bioswale or something would work and function here and can be maintained, why not combine the two? That way you're killing two birds with one stone. In some cases, what we have done is the existing landscaping chapter concentrated on dimensional requirements. You must have landscaping that is at least 10 feet by 10 feet. And it doesn't really say why. And certainly we're not going to say that you should have less landscaping because it's always good to have greenery. But recognizing that with stormwater, the conventional way of having the stormwater ponds put in the lowest area of your site, often in a corner, still allowed you to pretty much maximize development on your property. You put that in one corner and you develop everything else around it. The LID approaches, which tend to be more distributed and not necessarily at that low point, can in some cases mean that you are spreading out where your development can be. And in some quarters, some folks have said, well, that means that you're reducing the footprint of your building, where if you're a developer, that's where you're going to make your money. So if we as a developer have to shell out money for impact fees and parking and stormwater, all of a sudden the city, as part of that conspiracy we talked about before, is preventing them from making a profit. So where does it come into effect with landscaping? Where does it associate itself with landscaping? We have said we want to look at the intent of the landscaping, not necessarily how large the landscaping needs to be, but what it's intended to do. If it's intended to create a screen, you can create a screen through trellising or through some more vertical plantings. If the intent is to create a greater pervious area, then gosh, that goes right hand in hand. So we seek in our proposed changes to talk about what the intent is, much more than talking about what the prescriptive standards are going to be. Moving on to commercial and industrial planned unit development. And again, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer as we go along.
Right now you have a system set up to inspect stormwater ponds. How are you going to inspect something like that?
Such as the LID or the integrated with the landscaping? Well, I think Winnie can probably speak more to that, but we've hired Paul Knippel, who does inspect those things. What we would anticipate is that we would have easements leading to them, easements that are of sufficient size for if he needs a vehicle to go in, then he'd be able to access. I think that for the vast majority of the LID stuff, you don't necessarily need to go to it with a vehicle.
Right. A lot of the rain gardens, at least in residential, just end up being. Have you been down to South Douglas at all? Okay. Well, anything down there are. I'm trying to think of one up here more. Anyways, there are rain gardens distributed, so they're on people's actual property. A lot of times, we prefer that they're in their front yard, so you can just walk along the sidewalks. This is one of the major issues that municipalities have gone back to ecology with, because it's very, you know, time-consuming. Each year, you're supposed to go and inspect all treatment and flow control facilities, which those would be. It's going to be time-consuming for fall, but that's one of the main tasks that he was hired for. In businesses, it's a little bit easier, you know, because it's not as personal as a house, but it's going to be time-consuming.
How are we going to obviously go to one stormwater pond, done, as opposed to a dozen of these things?
Right.
How do we recoup the employee costs and having the added extra work to do?
Well, all ecology mandates are basically unfunded mandates, except that we do get capacity grants. We have gotten capacity grants in the past each year, which has been about $50,000. You know, I don't know how much time that actually covers, but like Dory said, we have easements on each of these that are either recorded on the plat or as a separate covenant. It's basically the developer's choice. You know, and it's difficult because some people who buy houses with them, you know, read the deed and are really into it and like to keep them up. And other people, oh, I didn't notice, but I signed anyway, and now they have to keep this up. And like I said, there's a soil profile. You can't just, you know, go in and garden way deep down. You're going to have to keep a specific soil.
Is there a way to lessen the amount of them as opposed to
actually,
a dozen and make it to six or four?
I actually went to ecology and asked if we could prohibit them in residential areas and just strictly do commercial, because that would be my preference. But that's basically, not going the direction they want to go. So at this point, it's just up to the developer how they want to do it.
So they can add whatever they want for these things, as opposed to we give them. For something like this, you're going to have to come up with it in six as opposed to year 12.
Right.
Do that?
I don't believe so, because it's basically we'd be telling them how to do their stormwater report. I mean, I don't know.
Well, we tell them how to do stormwater ponds, so I don't see why this is different.
Well, not necessarily, because they basically take their development size and the impervious surface, and then they calculate how much water, and then that sizes their pond, or it sizes their swale, or their ditches. So it's basically how big they need to make it based on the manual. And so the rain gardens would be also sized to that degree.
Okay.
It's kind of a pain for the developer, so I don't anticipate them making a lot more than they need to, honestly.
Okay.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Yeah. Ms. Lark, do you anticipate probably more and more of the rain gardens that's going to become a regular feature in new developments?
I think so.
Yeah.
You already said that the Planning Commission was saying that they felt like the rain gardens kind of distributed the area, but a lot of developers feel like they get a lot back because, you know, they still are selling lots with the rain gardens. The rain gardens are typically on, or they all are, on, unless you create them to be on homeowner association property specifically, like a little mini park with the rain garden, a lot of them are on specific people's property. So you're still selling that lot, whereas if you have a pond, that's not a house you can sell. So a lot of developers feel like they're making money.
What kind of maintenance is required if owns one?
Well, most of them are, they have specific plants that you're supposed to plant in them. Typically, kind of sounds counterintuitive, but they're like drought resistant. So, the first year you're supposed to water them, but then after that, they basically should maintain themselves, of course. As we all know, I don't know, that doesn't really work out for a lot of gardens. But so it's basically like a garden that you'd have to maintain. And then if the soils do get mushed up or after a long time, you're going to, they're not working and you're experiencing ponding, then you have to dig it up and, you know, essentially you rebuild it.
And is Paul, doing a walk-by, able to tell whether that rain garden is functioning as how it looks? He has to wait till the rain?
Kind of a combination. So
that's part of his responsibility,
right.
And then he notices the homeowner and says, you have a problem here.
Well, so if he does his initial look and, you know, the vegetation looks great, the soil still looks great, then he's probably, okay, that's good that year. If he's noticing ponding or the vegetation isn't there, then, you know, he'll do a double check during a rainy event and make sure, you know, and obviously I think if the homeowner's house is flooding, they're going to let us know, so.
Yeah, and, you know, a properly functioning rain garden drains, really, and doesn't have water pooled up in it. You know, and it's pretty easy that when you see a poorly functioning one, you can look at it and you can see the ring around the water's routinely pooling up to the overflow level, that, you know, you can go back and assess it even outside of that kind of high flow event, that you're going to be able to physically see the pool.
And we are having the developer's engineer certify these low-impact developments, development BMPs when they go in. So we're going to receive something from their engineer saying, yeah, I watched it go in, I tested it, it's functioning, you know, so they're starting off well.
One other question, Wendy. All the newer ones were belonging to the Homeowners Association. They have to get paid, inspected, and all that. So now we're stepping away from that, and we're assuming those costs once again, like the city owns. Is that correct?
Well, the homeowner is still responsible, or the owner is still responsible for all the maintenance in the same way.
I mean, the inspection. Weren't we saying the inspection on the homeowner-owned ponds, they had to pay for it, or we still inspected them?
If they're built after 2010, our permit requires that we do an annual inspection, so a lot of the ponds we're still inspecting once a year. Anything prior to that, I guess you're on your own, but we still will, you know, inspect if you fall. it's still an annual inspection. Maintenance is on the owner, and we, you know, encourage people to inspect them on their own, so you make sure, you know, preventative maintenance, basically.
Thanks.
Councilmember Taylor?
So what if a homeowner doesn't, you know, keep their rain garden up to par, and you inspect, and there is there can they be imposed a fine or?
Yeah, we have a stormwater control ordinance, so it's basically just, you know, sort of like a nuisance. If your stormwater facility is found to be out of repair, then we'll send you a letter or talk to you if you have a chance to repair it. If it's not happening, then we'll start the enforcement process, which is the same for the whole city. So it's once you've been notified and you're ignoring us, it's $1,000 today after notice of violation has been issued.
That's another Hanson.
And so we're ultimately, in from the new neighborhood thing, some people are going to have this responsibility, others won't.
Right. So it's important to check your deed. Like always, you know.
Councilmember Mazar.
So, but in this rain garden situation, it would be easier to enforce it, essentially, on individual property rather than the homeowners association, where sometimes those dissolve or fall away and then the city is.
Yeah, and that definitely is a plus for us. It's, you know, you can end up down the same road where, okay, they're not even paying their fine, it's lien on the house, we'll wait till they sell the house, you know. That's always a worst-case scenario, but it is easier, I think, to enforce on an individual than on the HOA, because, like Councilperson Czar said, if the HOA has dissolved or you don't know who the president is, you're knocking on doors, you can't figure it out, oh, we don't have one, then it's like you have to look at the whole development and put a lien on everybody's house. I don't even know, but, you know, luckily we haven't had to go down that road yet. But thank you.
Any other questions? Councilman Watson.
I actually have a question for Yori, but I want to make sure that it was done with Wendy.
Yeah. Are you folks done with Wendy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yori, quickly, in this section, you said you had two areas that you need direction from council. Do you want to come back after public hearing to talk to us about that, or do you want to ask us now about those two areas for landscaping?
Yes. I'm just
page 120.
Load back up. The... I'll ask them now and give you some time to think about it. First of all, I did reference a little bit in that code section 1874-140C, where it says that we require a 7-foot landscaping area between a parking lot and a street. That's where I was talking about the dimensional requirements. It's not clear why we have that. Again, I believe that the reason for that, and the Planning Commission indicated that this is likely the reason for that, is to create a visual separation so you don't have this ocean of parking right next to the street, so that there is a feeling of separateness.
It wasn't tied to impervious surface in the parking lot. It was purely for aesthetics?
That's what everybody remembered.
Okay. They've been here a long time, so.
And if that is the case, if it is for that separation, because that would really be the first time that it referred to pervious surfaces in the existing chapter, so because it would be kind of random for them to say, we really need this for the purpose of pervious surfaces in this section. So I think that it just was not on their radar when they wrote this. If the reason is to create that separation, you might not be able to do it in 7 feet, depending on what you put in there. If you just put some sticks there or nothingness or grass, you might need miles to create a separation. But if you create a vertical element, even in trellises, maybe you only need 6 inches or a foot to do that. So what I would like from council is some direction. You get to decide. Do you want there to be that visual separation? Or do you feel that just having 7 feet without necessarily saying precisely what's in that 7 feet is sufficient? I have a guess on what way it was originally intended, but I can't infer that. The other question is, again, with parking facilities. We say in our existing code that if you have, I think it's 100 or 99 spaces or less, we require 5 square feet or 10 square feet of landscaping per parking space. But once you get over 100 parking spaces, all of a sudden we require 15 or 20 square feet of landscaping. I believe that the reason for that is to say, once you get over 100 parking spaces, you have a large parking lot, and therefore it will take more landscaping to reduce that heat island effect or that ocean of parking lots. But is that the intent, and is that actually accomplished by adding in more landscaping per parking lot, or would it be better accomplished through some other mechanism where you don't just put all the landscaping on one side and you still have the ocean of parking lot, but, oh, your ratio is still meet. So some things to think about. I don't know that I've explained them terribly well. I can certainly draw bad pictures and see whether or not that would help.
And is it LID to do that?
And is it LID to do that?
Yeah. It's going to be a public hearing, but if you have any more technical questions, so Fiore? Seeing none, at this time, just for the audience.
I do have a couple
more
chapters. I'm sorry.
I am so sorry. You sound like you had that wrap-up sound there.
I do want to mention that one of the things going through this, we're not going to solve all of the problems that you folks discussed, but the fact that the stormwater people and the planning people have talked about these problems going through. When projects come in, Haley and Maddie and I are looking for those things so that we can hopefully bring them to the attention of the applicant, and then Wendy and Paul can also talk with them so it's not a huge surprise to them when we say, gosh, this is going to be really difficult for us to inspect. And most often, with the exception of Mr. Freeberg, the applicants are always willing to work with. So commercial industrial planned unit development, we don't propose too many changes besides allowing the integration of low impact development with buffers. Residential planned unit developments, it's a lot of the same idea, allowing them to have more flexibility in terms of what they propose, including some additional definitions that aren't related to stormwater, for like townhouses, usable open space. At the direction of the council committee, we removed proposed language that would have suggested that they would be able to reduce the width of their streets. That's going to be a discussion possibly for a different day, but we've removed that in this version. And then lastly, electric vehicle infrastructure. I don't think we have any changes proposed. And in RV parks and campgrounds, simply updating zoning. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
More technical questions. Councilmember Watson.
Just a technical question, what you just said about taking out the road part, is that also in where you say that you would say private streets will be narrower? So both those discussions are going to come later? Because part of it for the building setbacks, the language was because we expect private streets to be narrower. So has that been taken out as well? Because that's in a different section than under street design standards.
Do you have a page number that I can look at? Because I did just remove that one section that was the topic of discussion.
No, I don't have I'm sorry. I don't have the... Because that's actually in the code, and I don't have... This version, I don't have the code that you changed. I apologize.
My belief in writing through that... Mm-hmm. Was I did not feel that there was anything with that possible exception of that line that obligated us to have reduced streets. Okay. There were some sections in our PUD ordinance that talk about the ability to be flexible, but it didn't infer that there was an automatic assumption for reductions.
Okay.
But I can't say for absolute certain that there is not a code section that we proposed adding. Perhaps, gosh, I don't know how there would be a motion that would.
We could pick it up later.
When we have the other discussion, if we discover that when we're having the other discussion, that would be fine. I just wanted to make sure that that wasn't part of this discussion.
It's not my intent for this to be part of.
Thank you, Jerry.
Any other questions? So we will open the public hearing. I can't see the clock, but. It is what it is. And our clerk is going to read the process for the public hearing, and this is for the audience.
Okay. A public hearing is a formal opportunity to give testimony to the council for consideration in their decision-making process. Written comments may also be submitted to the city clerk prior to the beginning of the hearing. When the mayor calls your name, proceed as follows. Audience members who signed up prior to the beginning of our meeting will be called to first to speak at this public hearing. If you were unable to sign up before the meeting, you will be given an opportunity to address the council once we've gotten through all the speakers listed on the hearing sheets. Each speaker should state his or her name and address for the record and will be given 3 minutes to address the council. When a large group of individuals supports the same position on an issue, we encourage the selection of one or two representatives to speak on behalf of the entire group.
Good. And there's a sign-up list? Okay. It looks like two have signed up. Cinda Gardner? Am I getting that close? Garber? Oh, come up. You get to introduce yourself, then we'll get it straight. Welcome.
So I have an example sheet here.
Could you say your name and address, please?
My name is Cinda Garber, and my address is 8741 Delta Line Road. Yes, sir. I recently moved into the area with my husband and purchased property here. And I am now currently employed as a school bus driver with Burndale School District. And I transplanted here from Cedar Valley, Washington, doing the same thing. And so I've been working down in the 39th district, which is Skagit County area in our area, where I'm from, on some safety factors that I like to try to implement for lighting for the school buses. Well, when I got moved up here, because I have a draft of a bill that's getting ready to be presented to Governor Inslee on that, the school bus issue. But when I moved up here and started driving multiple different routes as a substitute, I was kind of appalled to see some of the crosswalks that Burndale has. My orientation is safety is always number one. And by doing so, we have crossing guards. The objective is to provide safety for our children and pedestrians at all main school crosswalks and bring.
Ms. Garner, may I ask you a question? I'll allow you to keep going, but we're speaking about low impact development, stormwater, those type of things. What you're talking about is really important. Is this on topic?
No. That's why I presented, I thought it was a presentation to as a public opening of an
Did you come in a little bit late this morning? At the beginning we do that. But I'll tell you what. Because you didn't get here in time, at the end of our meeting, we'll allow you to do that at the council's pleasure. Because we're on a certain topic right now. We're not tracking well with you. We will track better if we could be devoted to that. Okay? Fair enough? That's it on the sign-up list. Thank you. Any other audience members want to speak on this topic? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing at whatever time we do that. And Director Burnett.
Happy to answer any questions. Try to answer any questions you have.
Council, what is your pleasure? Councilmember Olson.
I'll move the approval of Agenda Bill 1601-003.
Second. It's been moved and seconded by Councilmember Olson, seconded by Councilmember Goodrich. Is there more discussion or questions? Councilmember Watson.
Yuri's still waiting for us to tell him what to do with the vegetation buffer and with the 100-plus cars. I guess with the vegetation buffer, there's no equation that's used. People just picked 7 feet of stuff. That's not where they pulled it from.
What we have in the landscaping chapter is are a number of different examples. We have the L1, L2, L3, L4, and they go in order from the L1, which is the most minor, to an L4, which is you have a fence and you have dense shrubbery. The chapter already states what you need in different circumstances. So we already know that for that sort of configuration, we would need an L3 buffer, which is a high-screen landscape buffer. So I know what it's supposed to accomplish. It does accomplish that visual separation. I don't know why it needs to be 7 feet, though. So my take on it would be is if we just say high screen visual separation except for life safety for the vision triangle, then we'd be good to go. And that's how I have it.
So you could just say L1 whatever with whatever depth necessary to accomplish.
Exactly. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Do you don't need us to give you the words? I mean, with the motion on the table as it is, will that work and you can just change it the way you need to change it?
With the motion in that manner, what I would do is I would remove that 7-foot requirement and simply refer to the L3 or L1, whatever it is in the matrix.
Okay.
Is that okay with council?
Did we discuss this at committee, this portion of it?
I think we did.
I don't recall it.
I think we were more focused on streets at committee.
Right.
I don't remember anything.
I'm just wondering if we're rushing into that part, why we didn't discuss that more in depth if you feel that strongly about it and get all the pros and cons rather than flying by the seat of our pants tonight. I'm not.
Can we pass this without the answers to those two questions?
Certainly. You could pass it as written, where I don't believe that we do change either of those, and we can come back later. It doesn't come up that often.
Okay.
And the way that I've administered it is there's a high degree of flexibility in here anyway.
Councilman Goodrich.
That was my question that Administrator Young asked. Do we have to do it tonight, or can we come back at a later date and change that one little part?
I'd just like to hear all the pros and cons, and that probably more time in committee.
Does that seem to be a consensus of council? Does there need to be a change in the motion, or is it okay as it stands, or what we suggest?
If you move the agenda item, then we're good to go.
Okay. More questions, more discussion? See you now. Ready for the question? Okay. Can we restate the motion, please?
Councilmember Olson moved, and Councilmember Goodrich seconded to approve the agenda bill.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The agenda bill has passed 7-0, and we have adopted the ordinance.
Thank you, Council. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, library sidewalk, and I think that is Kevin. our public works director.
Pass out some visual aids.
Are there more for that, sir?
Good evening. Chuck Burns, Public Works Director. Have before you the bid award for the rectangular rapid flashing beacon at the library crosswalk. Mm-hmm. And this is a pedestrian safety measure that we're looking to realign the crosswalk across Main Street in front of the library. And if you look at the graphic, Katie was nice enough to put this together so that we could get kind of an overview of the area that we're doing the project in and looking at what's happening. So if you look right now, there's a crosswalk that goes directly across Main Street, and then with the yellow arrows pointing to it, there's a crosswalk which goes halfway across to an island in the center, does a little diagonal turn, and then goes and lines up with the front door at the library. Included in that on each side of the Main Street facing the oncoming traffic lane is a rectangular rapid flashing beacon. Now, these are a solar-powered sign that has an LED flasher on it. Each side has a button that you can push when you want to cross the street, and they talk to each other wirelessly back and forth. There's a solar panel on top, powers the batteries, charging up so that it can be used day or night, and provides a fairly good, you know, flash that gets the attention of cars. Now, I've looked at around a little bit of information. Federal Highways Administration did a study of these exact type of beacons and found some pretty surprising, like, advantages to them. First off, with the type of system that we're putting in the study area that they did in the Federal Highways program, it looked to be about 15 to 18% of people yielded to pedestrians that were waiting to cross the street, which I think is kind of fairly consistent with what you could see just anecdotally driving up and down the street and people buzz by the people that are waiting at the crosswalk. After the installation of the rapid flashing beacons, that changed into the mid-80s for a percentile of people stopping for the pedestrians at the crosswalk. Additionally, to the increase in the number of people that are stopping there, we're providing that refuge island in the center so people get halfway across and the car hasn't stopped. They have a little bit of a refuge that they can take out there in the center of the road. The project was recently put out to bid with an engineer's estimate of about $102,000. Bids came back just a little bit higher than that. The low bid was with Strimler Gravel, a company that we've done business with before. I think that Katie was saying that the Molloy project was completed by Strimler. Have a good reputation. We've done good work with them. Their bid came in at $108,000. We had about a 10% contingency on there. The contract that we're looking for approval for tonight is for $120,000 for the construction of those improvements. Additionally to that, we did receive some funding from Phillips 66, who gave us $20,000 towards the project for the completion of the crosswalk. So,
so council already approved the project. Tonight we're approving, I'm assuming, the contract. Any questions from council? Councilmember Goodrich.
Just a curiosity question. How much are the flashing beacon, just one of those guys?
You know, I think you ordered them, were they about 12,000 for the...
No, 10,000
for the beacon. So
I was just thinking down the road, if this pans out, we might want to do something at Main and Hovander, because that's kind of a... People come flying around that corner if there's somebody in that crosswalk, if they had a button and it would kind of warn people that if they're not very expensive...
Pop a John would like that.
Put in there, yeah.
Other questions? Council, what is your pleasure? Councilmember Watson.
Move to approve Agenda Bill 1601004.
Second. It's moved by Councilmember Watson and seconded by Councilmember Hansen. Are there any other questions, discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the contract, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The contract has been approved. Okay, thank you. And we'll be done by the weekend, huh?
I did neglect to say that the project, the contract, calls for 15 working days for them to complete the project.
And within that, there's a little bit of contingency due to weather and the timing of the paving. So we may do the project with a temporary patch and then come back and finish that project when the paving plans open back up. But we have that all worked into the contract, so
beautiful.
We'll be taken care of.
Are they going to flag it or do flagging?
Yes.
During that section?
Yes.
And a lot of public awareness.
Okay, next item is our contract with the Humane Society, and our city administrator, Mr. Young, will take care of it.
This is a renewal for 2016 for our animal control contract. There was a question that came up, I believe, during the committee's deliberations having to do with specifically, I guess this may be oversimplification, but domestic animals versus wild animals. I think we're all aware that Humane Society, what they do, but I guess the issue is there a difference in their services between domestic and wild animals? And so we've invited, is it Linda?
Laura.
Laura, I'm sorry, Laura from the Humane Society, so she can certainly answer any questions you might have.
Good evening. I'm Laura Clark, Executive Director of the Whatcom Humane Society. Yeah. And before you start asking me questions, which I'm happy to answer, I would like to congratulate the City of Ferndale for being the only progressive municipality in Whatcom County that does cat licensing. You set an example that all cities should follow, and I tell them all that every time I meet with them. So thank you. Thank you for setting a great example that all animal owners, especially cat owners, should follow. And I am happy to answer any questions about our longstanding relationship.
Councilmember Olson has some questions.
You bet. It was actually me. It was an incident probably 4 years ago. But I read your correspondence with Greg and back and forth. And it looks like the situation has changed because I had something burrowing under a shed. I had no idea what it was. So I got one of those safe humane trap things, stuck it up there. And I have a nosy neighbor who eventually what was under there came out. It turns out it was a skunk. And when I called and asked for someone to remove it, I was told I have to pay for it because that's a trapper only thing, and et cetera, et cetera. And that irritated me immensely. But it looks like that's changed, and you guys deal with that?
Well, you still might be irritated.
Okay.
So, it is actually illegal in the state of Washington to trap and relocate healthy native wildlife unless you are a licensed state trapper.
And you don't have one of those on staff?
We do not. We are not what we call pest control or trappers.
Well,
but
see,
what we do have, which might make you slightly happier, but
okay,
maybe not entirely happy,
uh-huh,
is about 2 years ago, we assumed operations of a wildlife rehabilitation center that was operating in Whatcom County and due to financial difficulties went out of business, leaving the county with no organization to take care of injured or orphaned native wild animals. So the possum that gets hit, the skunk that may have an injured foot. So if you called us and said, hey, the skunk has an injured foot, wink, wink, we would come take care of that injured skunk.
Don't shoot the skunk.
For you with the goal, yeah, don't tell the Humane Society you're going to shoot the skunk. That'll be a whole other visit that'll come to your house. So the goal of our wildlife center is to rehabilitate and re-release animals into a safe native habitat in the community. But we can't, by law, Fish and Wildlife actually regulate our Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. We can't accept healthy wildlife. It either has to be orphaned, meaning it's this big, or injured in some way.
Well, here's the problem with that scenario. When you see a hole and you put a trap on it, you don't know what's coming out.
Absolutely.
Until it comes out and you see, oh, no.
Right.
So okay.
What we
but
would
I
do,
understand what you just said.
Yes. So what we would do in that case, and on our website, we have a tremendous amount of sort of educational mm-hmm. resources available because it is considered nuisance wildlife. And so we get a lot of calls, especially spring and fall, where people will say, hey, you know what, there's a squirrel in my attic. I don't want a squirrel in my attic. We get it. So what we want to try and encourage people to do is humanely get that animal out of where you don't want the animal, and then how to deter the animal from coming back in. And there's all sorts of ways that you can do that. So
with a squirrel, it's easy.
challenging, yes. And we actually employ two licensed wildlife rehabilitators, and they're really good about giving people alternatives. So they would go, okay, tell me about the hole and where is it, and here's what we can do.
It's rocked under there because I read
good job.
Those things are like salmon. They come back to where every time.
It's tough.
And
it's
I haven't
tough.
Had that issue because you can't dig up rock.
Well, what I can tell you that might make you as a council happy is that the wildlife rehabilitation center that we operate and the staff that we pay to operate it, we do so at our expense, and it is a completely donor-funded program, so we do not charge any of the municipalities any additional funds to either pick up injured or orphaned wildlife, dead animal pickups. That's all something that we do as a courtesy to the community. So while you may have not have gotten the best service, we're sorry about that, but we didn't charge you for it, so how's that?
She did come back and get it because she just wanted to make this whole thing go away.
I understand.
But, did I say she? I'm not going to say who it was. It was a really nice person who took care of it, but it was the person on the phone who didn't handle it so well.
Sorry to hear that, but it didn't sound like it was us at the time. So we can pass the buck and say whoever that horrible agency was, shame on them.
Quite a while ago.
Councilmember Goodrich.
Thank you.
I'm sure somebody else can help refresh my memory, probably Administrator Young or something. But I remember there was an issue with contractors and their dog and letting their dogs run wild, and the police were called. The police wouldn't do anything. And animal control was called, and they wouldn't do anything. Or people were pointing their pouches.
Yeah,
I don't remember the specifics. I just remember contractors and dogs.
Right. I believe it worked itself out. The issue was, as with home construction, it's not unusual for the workers to perhaps bring their pets with them. And while they could certainly keep them in their truck all day, many of them didn't want to do that, so they let them out. And dogs being what they are, they tended to roam around and frolic, and not everyone enjoys that when it comes to quiet neighborhoods. So we did have an issue about trying to, and I believe it was dealt with, I think, just by talking to the contractor, who then talked to his workers and asked them either to not bring the animals or, for that matter, kind of restrain them in some fashion if they are on the job site.
But the society staff didn't feel comfortable. They said they drove up, told him he couldn't do it. He pushed back, and they left.
Weak out on him.
He got very angry, yelled at them.
The complaint didn't hit my desk because our officers, if they had backed off without some type of resolution, would have ended up in my office. So what I can tell you, Councilmember Goodrich, is if you hear from any of your constituents or any of the council here, hear from any of your constituents that they're having any issues with our animal control staff or our Humane Society staff, I encourage them to have them reach out to me directly, and I'll be happy to look into the situation.
Yeah, I just remember it was brought to council, and I think that was the issue, was the animal control person just left and didn't resolve it at the time.
Well, my apologies for that.
Okay. Any more questions? Yeah, Councilmember Taylor.
Did you assist with the kangaroo situation?
We never got one call about the kangaroo.
Wow.
The paper reported it, and we had gotten some inquiries from concerned or just interested folks. Animal control, our officers are on call 24 hours a day. They never received any after-hour calls, any pages from 911. There is kangaroos. There is a facility down in Skagit, Snohomish County, that does have them. They are not illegal to keep, and they're sort of becoming a little bit of a fad pet, so it doesn't surprise me. I don't think it was a made-up call. I think there really was a loose kangaroo.
Oh, it was real. My friend works for 911.
Okay, but it never ended up in our custody. We do receive some very interesting animals over the course of our work, but that was not one of them.
Just a quick question. When on Facebook, there always seems to be a dog running loose every day, and people are trying to do whatever. If
a lot of us hesitate to call because you don't want to send a dog to the pound necessarily. So can you walk through what would happen if there's a dog running, you can't find its owner? Is it okay to call? I mean, are you gonna put it to sleep in 2 days or something?
Well, we're not the pound. We're the Whatcom Humane Society. Okay. I don't know if you've been to our new facility.
I have been to your new facility.
Okay, it's
but
nice.
When you think of it, you think of
you do, and it's
sending
the old,
a dog to the pound.
It's the old. I mean, if you had showed up at our Williamson Way facility, I would consider that a dog pound as well. We are very proud of our abilities to help animals in need, and I would encourage anyone who sees an animal in need to call us. Again, we're on call 24 hours a day. So a couple things can happen. So you find a dog, you call us, one of our animal control officers comes out, picks up that dog. First thing that happens when the animal arrives at our shelter is we scan it to see if it has a microchip, which is a permanent form of identification. We microchip animals for $20. Animals take it home, see if the animal has any ID. If the animal doesn't have any ID, no tags, no microchip, and we've gone through our lost and found books and there's no match, the animal is then vaccinated and goes into our stray holding kennels. By law, it states in your contract even, we have to hold that animal as a stray for 72 hours. We don't think that's enough time for an owner to come looking for an animal. Especially it's holiday weekend, you know, who knows what's going on. The pet sitter lost the pet, didn't tell the family. All sorts of scenarios happen. So we, as the Whatcom Humane Society, hold animals for 5 business days, not counting the day they came to the shelter or any days we're closed to the public. We're closed to the public on Tuesdays and major holidays. So it's basically 7 days. The animal with no ID sits in our kennels to see if an owner will come looking for the animal. If that animal that comes into our facility has any type of ID or any potential for an owner, say we've seen something on Facebook saying, I lost this dog. Well, that's the dog right there.
So you do check Facebook. Not
you
just
check
so
Facebook
the
about
10
times a day.
Okay.
Then the animal is brought in as a stray with a potential owner, and then that becomes a 14-day hold for us.
Okay.
We then try and notify the owner in writing up to 3 times, by phone, and any other means we can. Let's say we've exhausted all those resources. There's been no owner. No one's shown up to look for their animal. Animal's just sitting there. We then evaluate the animal, and based on the animal's health, age, and temperament, they either go up for adoption, they get transferred to a breed-specific rescue, so let's say it's a purebred golden retriever. We would then most likely contact a rescue group that specializes in golden retrievers, transfer the animal out. Or they go up for adoption. If the animal is aggressive to people or other animals, they would not be placed up for adoption. Okay. It's a liability for us. It's a liability for your community for us to place that animal back into the community. Our new facility has changed our life. We don't euthanize animals that have minor behavior problems. We have professional dog trainers who volunteer their time to help animals with those problems. We have a full-time veterinarian that works on staff for us, so we're able to handle most minor or even major medical issues.
So I think you'd be more willing to call if we knew that
sure.
You weren't sentencing the animal to death in 72 hours.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's old-fashioned humane societies, and I get it. I encourage anyone to come down and look at our new facility. We love it, and
maybe that's something for the Facebook page.
I was just thinking, once you guys are in New York, then we will.
Thank you.
You bet.
That was worth hearing. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Laura, any more questions? Councilmember
Olson. I'd like to move for approval of Agenda Bill 1601005.
It's been moved and seconded. Moved by Councilmember Olson, seconded by Councilmember Hansen to adopt the contract. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay, and the contract has been adopted. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We look forward to serving you, and there are kittens in the car for all of you. I'll go
right
in
the back.
So.
I would take one.
Are they licensed? They will be licensed because I know you are all very responsible. And thank you again. I'm not kidding. You guys rock for doing that. So
thank
all
you
my
so
cats
much.
Are licensed.
Thank you.
With council consent, I'd like to insert, excuse me. Wait, I thought we said aye.
Did we?
Yeah,
I think we did.
Yep.
I guess I said.
Would you like to do it again? Yeah, we got it passed. Yeah. With council permission, I'd like to invite Ms. Gardner to come back, and she missed our earlier open comment. Then we'll go to mayor reports.
And the 3-minute limit in effect.
3 minutes, you bet.
That's you.
That's you.
Sorry, guys.
School bus driver, you live up near Blaine. We hate to send you back empty-handed.
Oh, I got it. So my agenda and objective is I want to provide safety for our children and our pedestrians at all main school crosswalks and bring awareness to vehicle drivers. Knowing that this is a small community, such as where I grew up at, you guys have massive traffic in within your city limits, and we have a very convoluted bus routing system here with our school buses that are very busy, and along with our public and vehicles and alike. So it brought to my attention at these crosswalks. I noticed that when I first started working here in September with the district that you guys had City Patrol, you had the SCOPES program, you had crossing guards, and upon doing some research a little bit, upon discovery, there's still some implementing that looks like it needs to maybe be addressed towards the safety of these students at these crosswalks. So what I did with this sheet of paper that I passed both directions is that I would like to propose this, and not being an engineer or not having the facility or the elements to be able to know exactly what it's going to take to do this type of project. But my idea tonight is to just bring it to the table and at least propose it as a table discussion for maybe a future project to look at as a pilot project. I consulted with various crossing guards, school officials, local police officers, and SCOPES program guards, and all concluded that this is a great idea to implement. The more the awareness, the better the safer of the children's safety is. How I propose this to be done is to somehow have an insert relay switch flashing lights in the lane of travel during school zone hours that are activated by the 20-mile-an-hour signage. And by doing that, example would be how this project could be constructed with the least amount of funds is when you can, as it's shown down at the bottom of the sheet there, I've kind of diagraphed it a little bit. I'd like to propose that in the crosswalks, in the center of a vehicle when it's traveling down the lane, where the tires are most likely not to ever run over this lighting system, it brings the eyes and the focus back down to the ground and what's in front of them, which is that pedestrian or that student. And in doing so, when the crossing guards was to go and activate the 20-mile-an-hour speed zones signs, that whether there be some type of a wireless remote or a solar panel, but there be some type of a relay switch that would interact with these 20-mile-an-hour signs. And when the crossing guards turned those on, then it would activate the crosswalk flashing signage that I'm proposing. When the crossing guard shuts the 20-mile-an-hour signs off, then that shuts those down, and then it goes back to normal business.
So, Ms. Garner, would it be acceptable to you? You've written this out. I don't know how detailed the sheet went around.
It's over there.
Could you provide that for me?
Yeah.
I'm going to give it to our public works director to take a look at it.
Yeah, he has a copy of it.
I'll have him get back to me, and probably we'll bring it to the public works committee.
Okay.
I want to get back to you, so can you leave your contact email, that kind of
stuff?
Sure,
absolutely.
I want to thank you for coming today.
I just wanted to present an idea, at hand. So.
That's why we're here.
And then I've also included for a four-way stop, like at Vista and Thornton.
Great.
And then also the roundabout that's at Molloy, Vista, and...
So if you can give it to us really clearly, write it out, and either email it to me, and we'll get it to Upworth, okay?
And you can have this copy, too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
great. Thank you.
moving on to mayor reports. I have two. I'm excited about this first. Pardon me?
Yeah. I have a question to you. Including in what you give the mayor, you know, if you're driving around in a bus, is there some intersection or something that stands out as, if we were going to do something, this is the one to do it? I don't expect you to come up with something tonight. But
I gave some examples in that as some crossing streets. The biggest one that I see where there's a guard and a lot of times there's police officers parked there is Marine and Thorpe. Because parents are parking on the opposite side of the Skyline School or
Malloy.
Or Maureen.
You said, we thought we heard Marine, I think.
Yeah, I did say Marine. Yeah,
it's Malloy.
Down the hill? Or
by Skyline. Vista. By Skyline. It's Malloy.
Maureen.
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 Oh, excuse me.
M-A-U-R-E.
Probably my upriver.
Gotcha. My apologies.
So that one, and then I would possibly, you know, there's the new development that's going in up on top of Thornton on the other side of Horizon. But then we've got also Cascadia School, elementary school, and that's Captain's Way in Thornton. So I've kind of given some examples of cross streets of where potentially maybe a pilot project will be done.
Thank you.
As a highlight.
Others? Thank you so much. Mayor reports. A couple high school students, I forget their names, senior projects they do as seniors. They're putting on a masquerade ball, and they're renting our community center. We've given them the best sweetheart deal we could on the thing, and that is the 30th. So if you're 18 or under, you can go, but you might have young people might enjoy doing that. This has been a great project for these students, and one of the things that the mayor did was to get the newspaper on board. They didn't think of that, so it'll be out in the paper tomorrow, Wednesday. You can take a look at that then. And then finally, per your wish and request, we have scheduled the Ann McFarland parliamentary class, and we picked a Wednesday morning, thinking Wednesday mornings work well for you, March 23rd, and we are going to invite the Planning Commission members, and also we're going to invite council members from the other small cities if they want to participate, and probably the mayors too. So if we get a nice turnout, you get to meet some of your colleagues from other cities. So the morning time of Wednesday, March 23rd, probably 9 to noon, something like that. And I've taken it twice, and it's a very empowering kind of experience to learn some of the things from.
Do you have a location?
Pardon?
Location?
I work, it would be in Ferndale. It would depend on numbers. Yeah,
what was the time again?
9 to noon. It takes 3 hours. And we'll share the costs by having other people. That's all the mayor reports. Council reports. Councilmember Watson.
Tomorrow the voter ballots will start to go out for the M&O levy renewal. That's going to be due February 9th. If you need the information, the Ferndale School District website or the Yes Ferndale Kids Facebook page. And see, this Saturday, Interfaith, which is now called Unity Care, is going to be having a health insurance open enrollment session where they can help you figure out how to do health insurance if you don't already have it. And that's going to be 10 a.m. on 3rd Avenue, where Interfaith used to be. It's still the same place. They're just calling it Unity Care. They changed their names. Same people, just a different name. And it's from 10 to 2.
Thank you, Councilmember. Other council reports this evening. Councilmember Bursch.
The Ferndale Awards Banquet is this coming Thursday.
Chamber.
The Chamber.
Good.
I think it's a record crowd. I think they've got a wait list of, they've agreed to like 190 people.
Wow.
Sold out.
I'm in.
And if you show, you get to stop by the photo booth hosted by Sweeney's Portraits.
Really? Wonderful. Didn't know. Other reports from council members? Seeing none, we'll go to staff report. I'll just go on the line. Community Development Director Burnett, report?
Nothing.
Mr. Rentz, Public Works.
I think Katie covered most of the projects that we've got going on. She's not here anymore.
Yes,
so.
Great job. Our treasurer, Mr. Peterson.
Nothing.
No problem. Chief Knapp. Great. Our administrator, Greg Young.
One thing we had mentioned at the retreat that we might be able to arrange tours of some of the city facilities. You've seen the police station. I believe most of you have toured it, but we'd like to propose that any of you that be interested in kind of going through City Hall and kind of seeing where all those different colored blocks that I gave you on the schematic, where they work and how they do it, and then after that, perhaps go up to the city shop and see everything up there, and then down to the water sewer plant. We were thinking that perhaps after committees next Wednesday, if that works for, and I'm not really sure who would be interested, but if so, you could drop me a line if you're interested, and we'll put together a tour so you can kind of see the inner workings of the city.
And this is everybody, but especially the newer council members. Is that something you'd like to do? So he's asking for a response to see if next Wednesday after committee will.
Is that, is they think that'll work for at least the three that potentially?
Good.
Can you invite the media to come to give them a chance to invite Brent and Joe to see if they want to come too?
Yeah.
It's thrilling.
So maybe we could do like an 11 o'clock light lunch or something like that.
Absolutely.
So committee meetings are over at 11 now.
Yes.
Right? So a light lunch at 11, then we'll go through City Hall. Actually, why don't we go through City Hall and have lunch at noon?
Yeah.
So we'll start the tour at 11.
Yep.
Can we do that? A City Hall tour at 11, that's before the lunch break for everybody. We can let them have lunch with the City Hall staff.
There you go.
We'll figure something out. We'll feed you, and
poor
then
staff.
We'll do public works and then the water sewer.
Exactly.
You'll warn those guys for us?
We will, we will. They'll be sure they're clean the place up.
And clean the microwave before
they exactly, exactly.
Our communications officer, Mr. Clerk?
Nothing.
Great. I think that's it. I would entertain a motion to end our meeting tonight.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.